From Sylvain Labs, welcome to Critical Nonsense. On our show, we dig deep into cultural ephemera and pose questions to each other to inspire interesting conversations. This is Critical Nonsense. This week, Aaron asks Joey about canceling artists, and Joey asks Aaron about saying no to social media.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hello.
This is what a Joey sounds like.
This is what an Aaron sounds like.
And this is what a social media entrepreneur, Jess Vander, sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess, social media entrepreneur.
That's so appropriate. What up, y'all? How's it going?
We're out here just singing Third Eye Blind before the episode.
Letting you know, and I just said this to Joey. I can't tell you what I just said to Joey, but we'll see and we'll revisit it at the end and see if it works.
Maybe you'll see it in the special thanks.
Perhaps. Mayhaps.
Stick around.
Stick around. After these messages, we'll be... Anyway, So I got some brain wrinkles to de-rink with y'all.
You always have a new metaphor at the beginning of where your idea is coming from.
And none of them
are... I'm going to squish my mind grapes in your brain wrinkles.
No.
Accurately metaphored. So
metaphored.
Could be a word. It could be. So this week has been a weird week for Michael Jackson fans everywhere. And it shouldn't be said that it's only been a week. It's been since 1993, but and maybe even before then. But
it's been a weird 30 years.
Roughly. So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in since the HBO documentary came out.
Which HBO documentary, Aaron?
You know what's really funny? I don't even know the name of it. That's where we are these days.
Please hold.
Please hold. But if anyone hadn't been hearing about it, it was debuted at Sundance not too long ago, and audiences were shocked.
Leaving Neverland.
Leaving Neverland.
Is
there
Jess
it is.
Karen?
Wait, Karen, my mom?
Oh, no. What's the one from The Good Place?
Oh, Janet.
Janet.
Yes.
Jess is Janet.
Jess is Janet. She knows the whole world, the whole universe. She holds the... And that was really bad. Long story short, audiences and critics have been talking about Finding Neverland ever since it came out because of how starkly it painted the allegations related to Michael Jackson's pedophilia. And so where we are right now and what I've been feeling in a really, really deep way is, when should we cancel artists?
This is, funnily enough, this came up in separate conversations in my life with different people, and everyone has a different opinion on this, which I think it is interesting to see, you know, how someone processes this idea. Like, no one is like, Michael Jackson did the right thing. Like, no one is making that argument, but there is sort of this distinction, right? The big question being, how do you separate art from... The artist, I think, is the crux of it, right? Like, that's...
Yeah. I think it's definitely part of it. Like, there's so many artists, and it's not just musicians. It comes up in so many different, like, fields. And when you think about R. Kelly, this just happened to him, like, again, over the past, you know, 20, 30 years. I almost feel weird having just said, like, happened to him, because that's wrong.
Yeah.
Like, this situation and... fans and the public struggling with these two mentally incongruous realities. It's been happening for 30 years. But you've got the R. Kellys of the world. You've got the Mel Gibsons that are out there. You've got Michael Richards from Seinfeld. Like, there are all these people who are known for creating art that has a huge impact on the way that people connect to each other and the way that culture itself evolves and changes. But at the same time, like, what they did and what they are alleged to continually do is so abhorrent, it forces you to really interrogate, like, do you put your money where your mouth is? Do you actually believe that you can't support artists when they're bad people?
Yeah.
Or even worse, when they do bad things?
Yeah, the interesting part about this is the retroactive component of some of this, right? Like, Michael Jackson is dead, right? Like, at this point, he's not receiving anything based on his acts. Like, the money goes to his estate or his trust or whoever. You know, like, I know different people have owned and the rights to different things that he's created over time. But there are people who are still alive where we're still grappling with this question, right? Where you're saying, like, I developed a relationship with Michael Jackson songs when I was, you know, like 6 years old, 5 years old, like listening to Beat It while my aunt was literally chasing us around, making us do chores and hitting us with a stick.
That's amazing.
My aunt, you know, great family. but that, you know, like you have this old relationship that you form before fully understanding the sort of extent to which someone's behavior went, right? Like we didn't know when I was a kid what was going on with Michael Jackson, right? Like I was 9 or 10 by the time even the earliest allegations started coming out around Michael Jackson, and had a fairly, like, both with his songs as well as Weird Al Yankovic parodies of his songs. And so the question becomes, like, no one's supporting the behavior, but if someone is receiving, they're continuing to receive, you know, checks off of the back, royalties for their music and things like that. One thing that I've seen that I found kind of interesting is when someone is brought to justice for the things that they've done, and maybe we can go and look this up after and add it to the website, thisisnonsense.com. Jess puts all kinds of great show notes and links and articles and stuff up there. You should check it out.
Immediately, please.
But there, I've seen some judges, when something like this happens, transfer the royalties to whatever the art is to the victims after, you know, moving forward into the future. And so that sort of...
O.J. Simpson, Ron Goldman's family.
Yeah. It sort of removes the guiltiness from the consumption of something that you already have a relationship to. It sort of abdicates you needing to make a decision because someone was brought to justice, and you know, in some way moving forward, justice is continuing to be served, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's a financial element to it of who's getting the money and who is making the money off of the art still being out there. But then there's also just the pedestal, like putting people on a pedestal for so long. Because back in 1993, these things about Michael were being talked about, and there were lots of specials and conversations about whether or not this felt like something we could talk about. But over time, we still supported the music that Michael created because ostensibly it's the music was more important than people's lives, right? And that's in theory the same decision that we make over and over when we choose one artist. But and this is a big thing for me at home. If R. Kelly is playing on the stereo, I shout at Janet to turn it off, because I fundamentally am like, I don't want to support R. Kelly. Like, this is just too wrong. This was way before the movie, the Lifetime movie and all that kind of stuff came out. But there's so many other artists that I don't yell at it to stop. And there's so many other artists who, in theory, I should be equally as enraged and equally as conscious about. And like, is that okay?
Yeah, this reminds me so much of the crux of a piece that Claire Dederer, I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, from the Paris Review wrote about a couple of years ago. And she basically says, the question she poses, which is, I'm going to read it verbatim because it's so well put, is, what do we do with the art of monstrous men? And it's grappling with this idea of, like, can you separate the work, you know, the genius from... you know, this person and who you know them to be and some of the monstrous acts that they've committed, especially as time changes and some of those things that might have been something to be slid under the rug are just completely not acceptable anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Picasso is a prime example of this, right? Like, over time, the stories that came out both after he died and sort of later in his life that were starting to emerge about his relationship with women, his sort of predatory relationship with women that maybe didn't, and I don't know everything about Picasso, that maybe didn't border into the technically illegal, but felt very, very icky from just a like moral perspective. Like the things that he was doing felt very predatory. But you're like, he invented, you know, cubism, and he produced all of these great works, and he's still in museums around the world, right? And so do we stop talking about him? Certainly we don't agree with his behavior. And so where do you draw that line? Do you have to then say, like, you know, there's something. So whenever it was in 2012, you know, Chick-fil-A came out that they were like supporting anti-gay rights groups or like, you know, American Family Pack, mm-hmm. or whatever it is.
Which is why I'm still sad that I can't eat Chick-fil-A. But go.
So no, what I was going to say is the way that I reconciled that, because I was like, I really like Chick-fil-A. It's so good. Was I would make donations in equivalent amounts every time I went to eat. And I wasn't eating at Chick-fil-A often. I was doing it like twice a year or something like that. But then I would donate to the HRC to say, okay, a little bit of the money that I gave Chick-fil-A went to this, but, you know, some small amount. But then I can make an equivalent donation to the Human Rights Campaign and make sure that that's being offset, sort of like a carbon tax almost.
Yeah. And while that sort of economic balancing maybe is an interesting ethical tack, I think the thing that might be harder to grapple with that is, to me, sparked by the Picasso conversation is, do you know about his etchings? Mm-mm. Because so obviously everyone knows Picasso very well for his paintings, but he got into a zone of etchings for a while, a series of which were depicting brothels. And sometimes Degas, his buddy who would like tour him around, would also be in some of the etchings. And it was super voyeuristic. And there was like this whole realm about it. But it's in those pieces, in a way, that kind of turn his sort of creepy and predatory behavior into his art. Right. Mm. And while maybe in a chicken sandwich, one's values or beliefs or whatever might not make their way into the fryer, with Picasso, those things are more inextricable. And I guess the question for me is, when the art can't be, you know, when the art can't be taken away from those acts, what do you do?
Yeah. Les Jacobs at our office, was talking about this yesterday, and he was bringing up the distinction between R. Kelly and Michael Jackson that is an interesting one, and I don't know whether it changes anything, but he was bringing up the point that, you know, Michael Jackson's music wasn't about the terrible things that he's doing.
That's a very good
point. Where, you know, it was about love or, you know,
fame, a lot of fame.
Yeah, being tough or whatever it is. And whereas R. Kelly's music had demonstrations of sort of how he felt about things. And he brought up a lyric that said that he's the Pied Piper of the rap game, which is effectively saying that he's like drawing in young women behind him, following him while he plays his music. There's sort of a distinction in that case where the art starts to demonstrate the particular behavior that we're saying is abhorrent or unacceptable, whereas in Michael Jackson's case, it didn't. And so supporting the art while potentially financially supporting the artist is different in Michael Jackson's case from R. Kelly's case. I don't know that it makes a difference at all, but I'm...
Yeah. Well, I think that both of those examples highlight there's a distinction between the moral decision that you make as an individual and the systemic ramifications and systems through which that art still proliferates. Like, other people are making money other than Chick-fil-A off of sandwiches, and other people are making money off of Picasso other than the Picasso estate. And, like, I think that a lot of the conversations that happen around these things keep it as, like, the artist is the bad guy, and then individual listeners are the people who need to, like, teach them a lesson. Like, that's kind of the narrative. And it completely ignores the fact that there are other people in between that have been, like, hosting their music and putting them on tour and making them more accessible to people so that they can't be forgotten. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be the argument, like, oh, we just make what the public wants. But I think to take away those intermediaries from the conversation puts an undue burden on both listeners as, I was about to say as well as the artist, but I think it's mostly just the listeners.
Yeah, so we're all to blame, basically.
Yeah, we're all to blame. We are all to blame. But here, it is the individuals and the businesses and the et cetera.
The question I have, and I think like we have a justice system, however flawed it is, which is supposed to sort of bear the burden of weeding these things out. And I, again, emphasize that it is flawed. But the issue is, you know, in this idea of canceling artists to demonstrate that you have a set of values that conflicts with that person and therefore the art they're creating, there is this issue of separating the beautiful thing from the terrible person. And I still struggle with that because there's a lot of artists or people that were consuming their things today that we just don't know that they're terrible. And again, I don't know whether that changes anything, but like we find out, you know, new people come out that they're terrible, but there's a lot of people that don't surface and we're still, I don't know that that makes any of it any better or okay. I'm just trying to think about like, can you, like, how do you reconcile how much you're supposed to litigate every day?
Right.
Like, how do you draw, like, doing research on every single thing you consume almost becomes sort of impossible?
It does. So this, The Good Place tackled this in a totally different way where they were talking about, I really do love the show. It's
television
now.
Television show, amazing show.
It's the best. It's absolutely fantastic.
Watch it. It's on NBC.
And
free ads.
I just want to make sure that I don't ruin anything. So I won't go into much detail, but basically this question of how much research do you have to do into every decision you make in order to be a good consumer and therefore a good person is a really interesting question that they tackle. And I think that the answer is that you can't. Like there are systems, and I'm not saying this is like oogie boogie conspiracy theory, man, but there are impenetrable walls to understanding the morality of any consumptive decision you make. You can't know where every, you know, glass manufacturer that created a bottle of beer for you got, like, what the labor standards were like, or where the water came from, or where the wheat was harvested. And, like, all of those things are actually unknowable to a degree. And I don't think it abdicates us from needing to be aware and needing to be cognizant of where and why and what we consume. But I think it does make it reasonable for us to not all expect ourselves to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And it gives me a little bit more solace when I say, stop playing R. Kelly and Chris Brown, but I don't say it to other artists.
Yeah, are you going to, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot. Yeah. So maybe I'm not going to do this. I was just going to say, are you going
to
still listen to Michael Jackson? And I don't really know how to, if it's not like I'm playing his music all the time, but you know, if Billie Jean comes on, my head's going to start bopping, you know, like, how do you separate that? I don't know.
So let's all go. This is not a plug for it, but like, let's watch Leaving Neverland and let's talk about it again and see what happens.
We'll follow up later and just say how terrible we feel.
Yeah. Seems great.
Let's bring it up before we're gonna bring it to maybe equivalently uncomfortable to the last story.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Joey, I figure, actually, I realize that the last several stories you brought are like, this is about to be extremely sad.
Yeah.
Or difficult.
I'm trying to tackle the important issues.
There it is.
It's true.
I had a different one that was just about me being socially awkward, which could come up next week.
I'm looking forward to that one.
But based on Aaron's story, or Aaron's question about this kind of canceling culture, it felt relevant to a big story that was coming out in the news this week. So The Verge put out this story, which is tough to read. Not going to lie. It was, I knew going into it that it was going to be tough to read, but it felt like something that was important. So I went in anyways, and I was pretty bummed out, and I've been thinking about it a lot since then. So it was a story about the moderators of Facebook and what it takes to do this job, and sort of just the dark side, the underbelly of Facebook and what's happening there. And fundamentally, the story is basically about how it's just ruining people. Right now, there, I think the story says there are about 5,000 moderators around the world on Facebook. And this training for moderation involves watching videos of brutal murders as part of the training process to see whether you're capable of handling the moderation job, because apparently there are frequent murder videos on Facebook that are coming up enough that someone needs to be able to handle that. But these people are burning out like quickly, like within a year, and leaving the job with PTSD, other advanced stress-related disorders, depression, drug abuse, all of these sort of, you know, people at the job are worried that people who burn out are going to come back and shoot up the place. And what's interesting is that, you know, Facebook is pushing this job off into other companies. So Cognizant and Accenture and like other big management consulting companies are setting up these farms around the world and, you know, creating really terrible working conditions. It seems like, you know, these people are being paid $15 an hour. They have like monitored bathroom breaks and very few breaks, and have to be like moderating a set number of posts a day. It's very like robotic, scary, big brothery. But my question ultimately, as like tying back to this idea of cancel culture and whatever, is, you know, if we're eating conservatively, like this application that people are using, Facebook, is eating the souls of 5,000 people a year, and we're just ruining them. Like, is that an acceptable cost for 2 billion people to go and, you know, look at photos of their friends' babies or catch up with friends from high school?
No. Okay, bye.
See bye. You.
Answer the question. No, it's not acceptable. It's not. And I think it's scary, right? Like, underneath all of that is the recognition that the digital era has allowed us to consume so much more that is outside of our realm of what we would typically see at a rate and volume that is in any measure unhealthy. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and I'm putting my tin hat on a little bit here, but like, there are people who have really difficult jobs to look at difficult content every day. I've got friends who work in like the DA's office, and they're responsible for working on child pedophilia cases. So they literally, through their training, had to look at really nauseating, horrifying images just to get trained, let alone to stay in the job. Physicians, like, they have to look at the human body contort itself in so many different ways every day, in a way that most people, the average person, wouldn't be able to handle. Those things all have gates that people have to pass through that are self-selected before you run into them.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on Reddit and stumble upon such horrible things that you can't unsee, that necessitate a subreddit for eye bleach. Like, the fact that that exists and the actual toll that it has on real people is abominable and terrifying.
Yeah, I'm sort of, you know, it's worth noting, first, eye bleach, Reddit is just cute things, right?
Puppies, fuzzy things, furry things. It's really nice.
Rainbows.
It's like the best subreddit. It's worth actually going to.
Which, if you see something bad, go to Reddit.
Eye bleach.
Yeah. But the, you know, the people that you mentioned, right? A DA, a doctor, like, those people are being paid in such a way that sort of offsets some of those things. And they're dealing with things in sort of a narrow window of terribleness, whereas these people are being paid $15 an hour and are seeing the full spectrum of shit that we can produce.
Oh my gosh. Joey, you just invented a new job. Actually, what? a new career path. Okay, so the beef here is basically like, all right, this whole new thing, this moderation job speaks to a really evil side of Facebook, social media, the internet being a place where we can connect bad stuff to people's eyes that are unsuspecting, right? They're not prepared. Is there a world where this moderation job becomes as socially meaningful as and high paid as jobs like a doctor or a lawyer? Because it actually requires, though perhaps we rely a lot on algorithms today to do much of the work for us, it seems actually like it requires a lot of something that is purely human for now to decipher what goes where and, you know, to sort that out. I granted, obviously, it's definitely not the same thing as cutting up a person's body to sew it back together in a way that heals them. But, you know, is there a way that cutting out the right videos, the melanoma of the internet, right? You know, like, could that become a new and sort of valued job in the future?
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. So this job, the people who actually work at Facebook, I think are paid quite well. Certainly, you know, tiers better than the people who are doing this at some of the farms that they're contracting out, which is interesting. And so those people that are doing it at Facebook are quality checking the people who are doing it at farms. So they're checking some of their posts to make sure that their you know, judgment on whether something is acceptable or not is correct. But they're being, you know, they have crazy good benefits. They have, you know, travel time. They're having to look at fewer of those posts a day, probably. They're in a healthier work environment. They're, you know, like getting all of these other things that the people at the farms aren't getting. So it's interesting, like, they're in this process. There may be someone who is in that sort of position. Meanwhile, they're sort of like the lower level minion folks who are just kind of being used as chattel a little bit.
Yeah, it's whether it is skilled or unskilled labor.
That's exactly right.
Right, because you can imagine that any human can look at something and say, like, that's bad. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to see that, and other people shouldn't see that. But there's a ton of skill in being able to withstand the volume of content that one would need to be able to withstand in order to keep together.
Yeah.
And that seems like it does justify that sort of compensation.
Right. And also, at the end of the day, it's, in addition to being a question of skill, it's also what you were talking about earlier, Aaron, which was sort of like the becoming unfazed to a thing that is scary, right? The reason army training is as long and as arduous as it is so that by the time you get to the point when things are really real, you are prepared and it doesn't really mess you up, ideally. And granted, it still messes many, many people up a year. But that idea of leaving people unprepared, and, you know, maybe hoping that they are skilled enough to tackle something that actually maybe we're biting off more than we can chew.
Yeah. And it's also not going to go away. This challenge is going to get worse.
Yeah. There's an existential question.
Yeah.
Right. Like, do we deserve or can we handle the power of this thing that we've created? Osei mentioned this week that there was a book written by one of the, I think it's called like Zucked Up. Maybe
Subway ads everywhere.
Are there?
Just all over the place.
Yeah, about one of the guys who was an advisor to Mark Zuckerberg when they were creating everything. And he was like, this is a lot, and sort of apparently warning against the existential issues of what we're creating. But the question is, like, do we need social media, or can we handle it in where we're at today? I don't know.
Yeah, and I also think that it is a question about us not social media.
Yeah.
Like, I know that we're talking a lot about Facebook, but like, this is why Tumblr has been, this is why Tumblr doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it does, but whatever. I think that they were trying very, with quite a bit of effort to stop their channel from being the internet, from being a place where any content can live freely and people have the ability to navigate toward or away from it. It's when algorithms start and news feeds and Twitter feeds and things that aren't self-selected start pushing us content that we didn't think that we signed up for, that it becomes a problem. And it only becomes a problem because somebody created it and put it there.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, again, the answer is that we're all to blame.
It's our fault.
It's still our fault. And this is what we make. I also think that, not to Spider-Man it up, but you got to do it once a week. With great power comes great responsibility. The internet is a really real, like, is a very truly powerful concept. And it's a truly powerful tool that is much more complicated than anybody gives it credit for. And I think very, very few people truly understand how to manage that power in an appropriate way. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing is sort of negative things being born out of social media. And the question is whether those negative things would be born out independently and social media just happens to be the vector, or whether social media is sort of creating a context in which that is more negative as a result, right?
Yeah, like, yeah. Ooh, scary stories you can tell in the dark. Yeah. Terrifying book from when many of us were kids. Still can barely look at the cover of it myself. And that, like, I think that a lot of schools banned the book because it was so scary. Like, it was truly, truly terrifying. I think they're making a movie of it, but my point is that with every media form, every media form allows content to become more accessible with less resistance.
Mm-hmm.
More people can get to it, and it lowers the bar for what it takes for you to fully digest it. Mm-hmm. Books to movies, movies to the internet, all that. And obviously that could be challenged, but without any sort of walls or barriers or things in the way to slow you down, the information just starts, it will go straight to your neocortex and you have to deal with it.
Yeah, the promise of the internet and social media and all of these things was sort of decentralization and democratization of information. That, right, like this sort of massively splintered and fractured system that allows you to consume information from your friends or from, you know, major outlets or institutions or whatever, compared to when we had three broadcast news networks in the entire country, is sort of the full swing in the other direction. And what the three broadcast news networks had, or at least what that idea offered while having plenty of issues, was that it was easy to regulate, so that if someone was lying or doing something illegal or whatever, it was easily seen. And you knew that there was a certain level of credibility and standards and whatever it was going through those channels. When we go to the full other end of the spectrum and completely decentralized information, you lose the ability to discern credibility or quality standards or any of those things. And then you wind up with people being like flat earthers and, you know, do you not know that people are flat earthers?
I do. And, you know, when I found out that rapper B.O.B. was a flat earther, this is neither here nor there.
Kyrie Irving apparently is a flat earther, although he's walked it back, but it just makes me really uncomfortable.
Okay, so I realized the title of the job I was describing before, based on what you were just saying, Joey. And I think it's internet librarian. With the fall of libraries in physical spaces, that curation job and expertise is a thing that doesn't really exist in official title. And I imagine we're only going to increasingly rely on something or somebody like that, because right, once there were too many books and it was like, we need someone who is an expert book knower to tell us what to do with all this stuff.
Yeah.
Which is obviously a hard thing to do with the infinite information that's on the internet, but
I mean, what's interesting, and to your point, and I know we can wrap this up in a second, is people that worked in this job who are coming in, who are like young, out of college, and it covers this in the article, like they were coming in not believing crazy ideas, and they're getting hit with these ideas so much because they're only seeing the flagged things that are like false or whatever. So they're like, there are people like starting to walk around the floor of these offices, like saying that the earth is flat or like the Holocaust didn't happen. Like just being inundated with these ideas enough time, like they're starting to radicalize just by repeated exposure. And it sort of shows you how sensitive we are. Like these people who went in who knew that this wasn't true going in and know that these things are being flagged for a reason because they're false, just with enough exposure are starting to be radicalized.
So then you agree. We need a librarian.
We need highly trained internet librarians.
Shh. Shh. That was really rude for people who are driving.
Hey, Alexa.
Jenny.
Wow. Wow. Oh, rude.
So mean.
I didn't give her an order. Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in beautiful New York, New York. MacGyver Studios, y'all.
We'd like to thank executive producer and internet librarian Jess Vander.
We'd like to thank erstwhile sound engineer Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank Designer. Designer!
Yeah.
Nora Mestridge for just being cool.
And with production help from Les Jacobs, Sara Gilbert, and Tony Vong.
And as always, thanks, Lynn.
Appreciate it.
We got special thanks.
Yeah, we do. I want to thank Third Eye Blind for giving us the album Third Eye Blind. It's a really good album.
It is a great album.
Cha.
I would like to build something, but you'll never see it happen.
There's this burning.
Like there's always been. I've never been so alone.
I've never been
so alive. That's basically social media.
Yeah,
they were predicting social media in 1997.
Who are you thanking, Joey?
I would also like to still thank Third Eye Blind.
I guess I would also like to thank Third Eye Blind to be the third to thank.
Yes. Oh my God, yes. Our eyes are open.
Yeah.
I mean, this has taken a turn, but I'm thankful for it. I would like to thank.
This has taken a turn as a name of. Almost our podcast.
Yes. Also that.
Ooh,
that's right. Ooh, maybe we change it.
Definitely not. No.
No.
I would like to thank all the new people who have been listening because that's great.
Welcome to the fold.
Thanks, guys.
I'd like to thank, just because we're there, Guster. Thanks, Jess.
I would like to.
Amsterdam. Yes.
I would like to thank all the emo bands that I listened to when I was a teenager. You know, something corporate.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Constantine came walking down the stairs.
Yeah. And her long brown hair. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know you're confused because none of the show was about.
We needed a dose of happy because we took it to a weird. I'd like to thank next week's episode because it's going to be a lot more uplifting.
Ooh, I agree. Unicorns, puppies, anything happy. Done. I also want to thank beer because that helped with this episode too.
Afternoon recording. Still hard, better with beer.
Accurate.
I would like to thank Farting in a Can in the movie
no!
Jack. In the movie Jack by Robin Williams because I watched that clip today and it made my day pretty happy.
That's really nice. I'd like to thank Will Smith for being the new genie. I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. I want to see what happens, but I'm okay with it. Yeah.
Does he have legs?
We don't need to know.
What genies have legs?
But it's live action. I bet he has legs.
He might have legs, but he got jokes too, and that's all that matters.
Wait, a live action genie? Wait, genies aren't real.
Yeah, well, no, but they are though. They are.
Neither are beasts.
Sorry, genies? Dude, maybe
or
real.
Or talking panthers?
Well.
Yeah, but even live action, a genie shouldn't suddenly sprout. Like
can we go back to that you met a couple talking panthers?
Just like they're really nice. Like
They're cool.
Oh man, I'm thankful that
this is spiraling.
We went off the rails. And I'm thankful for you and have a great week.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Crashes through the windows. I'm sleeping on the couch. When I came to visit you, that's when I knew that I could never have you. I knew that before you did. Still, I'm the one who's stupid. And there's this burning like there's always been. I've never been so alone. And I've never been so alive. Blink, blink, boop, boop.
Oh. Oh, yay. Yeah, we gotta do a podcast. All right, cool.